Hey guys, today's show is sponsored by Howl.fm. It's like Netflix for podcasts. You guys know this, but now a new feature, only with Howl Premium, you can listen to the Comedy Bang Bang 2016 live tour. The tour is sold out everywhere, but you can hear every single performance on Howl the next day. This year, Paul F. Tompkins, Lauren Lapkus, and Neil Campbell will be along for the ride. And there will, of course, be a few surprise drop-ins as well. So you can hear all 19 tour stops and 22 performances from CBB Live only on Howl. So guys, there's so much awesome exclusive content, and you can get access to all of it on your iPhone, Android, or on the web for only $4.99 a month. And with the promo code CRACKED, you get a full month free. To redeem your promo code, make sure you create your account on the web at howl.fm and enter code CRACKED at checkout. Remember, to hear all the Comedy Bang Bang live tour along with dozens of original audio miniseries and comedy albums, go to howl.fm on an internet browser. That's howl.fm. Of the Cracked Podcast. My name's Jack O'Brien. I'm the editor-in-chief of Cracked. And this week, we're listening to Old Dan Tucker by Bruce Springsteen, which is off the album We Shall Overcome, which is Springsteen covering a bunch of folk standards. This is probably my favorite song on the album. One of my favorite Springsteen vocal performances, really, overall, sort of an unhinged, maniacal Springsteen. Anyways, the song is one of those folk songs about a mythical folk figure who's larger than life, which is appropriate because the subject of this week's episode is real people and true stories that they didn't include in history books and movies because you wouldn't believe them if they did. That's something that happens a lot, actually. People make movies about true stories and then have to make the true story less far-fetched to make it believable. Like, we wrote about how in season 5 of The Wire, Omar jumps out the fourth floor window because someone's shooting at him and survives, and that seemed far-fetched to people. The Guardian wrote a review asking if the writers had been drunk when they wrote that scene, which is an understandable reaction. Falls from above the third floor of a building are rarely survivable, even if you land in a dumpster. Landing in a dumpster is basically good for keeping all your body parts in one convenient location for the coroner, like a bucket of chicken. But as we'll discuss today, sometimes there are those rare individuals who seem to be borderline unkillable. And the person who David Simon based the character of Omar on, a guy named Donnie Andrews, a real stick-up artist in Baltimore when David Simon was a reporter there, did jump out the window of an apartment building during a gunfight and survive, but they had to bring it down a couple floors. He actually jumped out a sixth-story apartment's window because when they shot it, they realized how fucking high up six stories look and how far a body has to fall when falling out a six-story window. And that happens all the time. There's a scene in the Johnny Depp movie about John Dillinger where he escapes from a jail cell by taking three guards hostage with a piece of wood. He's painted black with shoe polish. And that actually happened, only according to historians, it was between 17 and 20 guards he held up with a piece of wood. By the way, that's more guards than the number of bullets the fake gun he held them up with would have held if it were real. I saw that movie. I wouldn't have believed it if it was 17 guards. I wouldn't have believed it if it was 10 guards. But sometimes the truth is just way more far-fetched and more badass than should be possible. But so Dillinger and real-life Omar got movies. And today we're talking about people whose lives were too all-around ridiculously badass to even begin to describe without sounding like a crazy person. But fortunately, that's not a thing we worry about at Cracked. We're happy to sound mentally ill for your entertainment. That's going on our masthead. Anyways, rather than use this intro to talk about the theoretical concept of badassedness, I wanted to tell you one more story of an unknown badass I wanted to talk about during the live show, but didn't have the time, as a sort of appetizer, an amuse-bouche, if you will permit me to talk like an asshole. So the badass I want to tell you about is named Fritz Duquesne. And the reason you've never heard of him is he fought for the bad guys. He's basically a supervillain, but he's a supervillain with such an amazing origin story that you're like, now, I tend not to agree with Nazis, but... So he first made his name as a scout in a war these Dutch settlers in South Africa called the Boers had with the United Kingdom. He was on the side of the Boers, so... off to a good start, white South African and eventual Nazi. But in this first war, at least, he's probably on the right side. Basically, the Boers had been farmers in South Africa for about 100 years when the British came to Africa and were like, dibs, or dibsy-doo, or whatever the British version of dibs is. And the Boers were like, I disagree. We're the rightful invading white people of this land. 2, 3, 4, I declare a dumb war. So during this war, the British had an American on their side named Frederick Russell Burnham. And Frederick Russell Burnham is the guy I'd probably be telling you about if they didn't make a movie about him called Indiana Jones, or Indiana Jones and the dangerous word of the adventurous word. So that makes the guy I'm telling you about basically the bad guy in an Indiana Jones movie. So still pretty cool. So there were scouts on opposite sides in this war, which meant you snuck behind enemy lines and spied on the enemy. And Indiana Jones was the best at this on the British side, and our guy Duquesne was the best on the Boer side. And they've got a standing assignment throughout the war to kill each other, but they never do. And in fact, Indiana Jones becomes a fan of him because, you know, game recognized game. And there's a quote from Indiana Jones I want to read you. This also makes for great wedding vows if you have a wedding coming up. Quote, he is one of the craftiest men I ever met. He has something of a genius of the Apache for avoiding combat, except in his own terms. Yet he would be the last man I should choose to meet in a dark room for a Finnish fight, armed only with knives. Finnish, F-I-N-I-S-H, like fight to the finish. That quote is so much manlier than me that I don't even really know what a bunch of it means, but it seems pretty impressive. Anyways, during the course of the Boers getting their ass kicked in the Second Boer War, Duquesne got himself captured and put in a military prison in Lisbon, which is pretty bad news since the British openly want him dead, but he's like, nah, I got this. And he seduces a guard's daughter, and she convinces her dad to help get him out. So after basically pole vaulting out of prison with his awesome dick, he goes undercover as a British soldier to get some intel and goes around spying on the British and eventually gets himself stationed back in his hometown. And when he gets there, he finds that British troops have raped and killed his sister and sent his mother to a concentration camp. And he eventually finds his mother, but she's dying of syphilis and has had a child from a British soldier who probably didn't put it there using the subtle art of seduction. So this becomes the defining event of his life. From this point forward, he lives to kill British people, which it turns out he's pretty good at. He sinks 21 British ships during World War I by sneaking time bombs on board. And that's also how he gets revenge for what happened to his family. The war crime against his family had been part of a scorched earth strategy ordered by the commander-in-chief of the British Army, a guy named Lord Kitchener. And rather than being like, I'm going to get revenge on the specific soldiers who did this, he decided he was going to kill Kitchener. That'd be like someone being wronged by the U.S. military and being like, that's it, Obama, I'm hunting that son of a bitch down. Except Duquesne pulls it off. During World War I, he sneaks on board a ship Kitchener's on and signals a German sub about the ship's location, gets in a lifeboat, and then watches from the lifeboat as Kitchener and 600 other people go down with the ship. And then he gets picked up by the sub because apparently you don't fuck with Fritz Duquesne. So he's high on revenge, low on British people to kill, and wanted for murder. So he fakes his own death by claiming he was killed by armies of Amazonian natives trying to steal his vast treasures, which is a thing I would have made up when I was 5 years old. And this is where he starts living under like dozens of different identities. He becomes a big fan of this legal defense that isn't used as much anymore. The classic, no, you must have me confused with someone else defense. And that works sometimes because they didn't have photographs or DNA records. He got caught a lot. He wasn't a careful criminal or a smooth one, even. He was more like a pinball of angry testosterone, and the only thing you needed to make him go was just show him a motherfucker who spoke with a British accent. So that meant that he ended up getting caught a lot, and luckily he was just better at getting free, or I guess unluckily, since he ended up being a Nazi spy. Anyways, he escaped so often that reading his life story, you get the sense that like before World War II, being a prisoner of war just meant a guy like put you in a room and was like, hey, don't go anywhere. I'll be back in an hour. I'll leave the door unlocked in case you have to go to the bathroom. But you only get that impression because of how good he was at escaping. A few of my favorite escape stories. He was on a chain gang and used Morse code to communicate an escape plan to his fellow chain gang members. Another time he tunneled out of prison with a spoon, Andy Dufresne style. Another time he jumped into shark-infested waters and swam through a mile of sharks and boats looking for him. The sharks weren't looking for him, the boats were. But my favorite escape. So right when they caught him in New York City this one time, he started pretending he was paralyzed so that they'd move him to the prison hospital. And then he just started waiting for them to let their guard down, which it turns out took 2 fucking years. He pretended to be paralyzed for 2 years until they turned their back on him, at which point he disguised himself as a woman, leapt through a window, scaled a 6-foot wall, and walked out the front door. And when they put out the APB, they were still like, we're looking for a paralyzed guy who must, I don't know magic because he got up and climbed out a window. Because who pretends to be paralyzed for 2 fucking years? Fritz Duquesne, apparently. Among his other accomplishments, he became Teddy Roosevelt's hunting buddy, who took him on safaris and basically came away from hanging out with the most masculine American ever, thinking that Teddy Roosevelt was a bit of a pampered bitch. He became a pretty famous adventure journalist and at one point conned America into funding a plan to import hippos from Africa to solve a meat shortage America was having, because history is a fever dream being had by a pair of testicles. Anyways, he did eventually become a Nazi spy, but he was the biggest Nazi spy. When it was broken up, the Duquesne spy ring, as it was called, was the biggest espionage ring ever broken up in U.S. history. Anyways, his life is basically a mashup of like 3 different supervillain storylines, like every villain from all the different Indiana Jones movies. One master of disguise, one con man, one escape artist, one hunter, one Nazi spy. He was known as the Black Panther because of how good he was at killing things in Africa, the scariest place to kill things. Anyways, that's the sort of story that we're telling on today's podcast. Hope you enjoy it. I'll be back at the end for some footnotes. Talk to you later.
Get out the way, old man Tucker. You're too late to get your supper. Get out the way, old man Tucker.
Hello, hello. UCB Sunset. It sounds like there are actually a lot of you out there, despite the rain. So thank you for coming out in the rain. I know that's a big deal for you, LA. I'm joined on stage. I'm Jack. I'm joined on stage by a writer and star of many a cracked video, my occasional co-host, Mr. Michael Swain.
I'm going to take that in hand.
Michael, you look well.
Thank you. Well, I thought I should take our role pretty seriously today. We're going to be doing some judging. So for those listening, I am wearing a bolo tie and my best approximation of a judge robe.
Which is a bathrobe.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, today we're talking about badasses that you've likely never heard of, either due to an acute case of not being a straight white guy. History hates it when you're not a straight white guy. Or because they were on the losing side of the war or had stupid names. There's going to be all sorts of reasons you've never heard of these people, but they're all going to be incredibly, entertainingly badass. And Michael and I are going to sit here in judgment. So yeah, here's the format. We're going to bring out one of our writers who will present badasses for our approval, like a female baboon, except rather than being swollen and red, the asses they present will be underregarded and bad. You will then
really work to make that metaphor connect. I'm proud of you.
Just off the
I'm
top of my head. You'll then indicate your approval or lack thereof. We'll keep it going. Yeah, let's bring them out. You want to bring out our first
awesome.
One?
Let's do an example.
Yeah. Why don't you tell us about...
Well, as you said, I think a recurring theme of the night will be people who aren't straight white men or people whose names are difficult to pronounce. And I feel like if your name was too difficult to pronounce, there was a time before which people were like, ah, just write down Bill Simpson or something, you know, say he did it. So like a perfect example of what we were talking about is we all know Paul Revere's famous Midnight Ride, which single-handedly saved us from the British.
Right.
And
upon a midnight clear.
Cracked has made me, I guess, cynical enough that I assumed it was a fabrication. Or I'm like, I'm sure Coleman just created him to sell lanterns, you know. But no, there was a Paul Revere, so that's good. The downside is he did like the beginning of the ride. And then from, as most reports have, him just kind of petering out. And he basically handed the job off to two people, Samuel Prescott, who then completed a leg of the journey and handed the task over to Sybil Ludington or Ludington.
Hard to pronounce.
Hard to pronounce. Yeah,
it does not look good for her.
Sybil Ludington. And,
yeah.
And yeah, so she reportedly rode 40 miles all night, roused 400 troops, which was like the bulk of the people who ended up fighting and winning against the British forces were people that she went and woke up and got to come there. So basically, without Sybil Ludington, there's no America.
Yes.
Yeah, we all fade Ludington. Away from the photo, our family photos of ourselves. We just cease to be. And yeah, so like Paul Revere apparently stopped to rest at a tavern and just never got around
to it. Got drunk, yeah.
And she refused any stop, any rest, any comfort, and was just like, America.
Yeah, and so the only reason that we know about Paul Revere is because around the time of the Civil War, there was a poet who was trying to make this, like, poem, as poets do, and needed a name that was easy to rhyme with to tell this story and swell in the Union, like this feeling of patriotism, and nothing rhymed with Ludington or Prescott, literally. So he needed someone who, of the 10 people who rode that night, whose name rhymed with clear.
We needed a writer, so we the best got this right. guy named Samuel Prescott. I work a little harder, whoever wrote Paul Revere. Ludington would take me a minute, but yeah.
All right. Let's get to our first presenter. He is a hilarious stand-up writer and performer from Cracked. He enters every room he walks into cock first. Please welcome Alex Schmidt. Hi, Alex.
Thank you.
How's it going?
Thanks for understanding that we forced you into doing that and playing along.
Yeah. Yes, and?
I'm doing it.
You didn't need to take it out, though. Could it? Anyway.
So you're going to talk to us about a underregarded badass.
Yes.
That word, by the end of this, is going to just be nonsense syllables to me because I think we're going to say it a lot.
Edutain me, beyond. Yeah, I have the podium. Let's do it. I want to talk about, I'm going to call him Tisquantum, because that's what he called himself. But you know him as Squanto. And he's, I think, one of the most famous Native Americans, if not just figures in history. And he's famous for none of the cool stuff, for some reason. He basically, like, we know him as, oh, he was good at corn. But, like, actually... He basically lived the life of a Game of Thrones character in his own time in a way that never gets talked about for some reason. I think maybe we just don't want to think about the difficulty of that time.
He breastfed to a very old age, right?
Whatever. That's the character.
Yeah. Right, right. He was fireproof. But he was born in present-day Massachusetts in a village called Patuxent. So he spent his childhood being raised to be an advisor to the chiefs. And what that meant in their culture was all kinds of just like punishing trials. It would be spending winters out in the woods, a lot of fasting. They would also make people who were being groomed for this drink, this like herbal beverage that makes you throw up. And the idea was to just drink it until you started throwing up blood. And then they were like, ah, he's committed. And that was his childhood. That was how he grew up.
Also how we interviewed you for Cracked.
Yeah, but, you know, that's normal.
I'm gonna irresponsibly let people know it's called ayahuasca. If you want to look it up and try that at home. I've heard good things.
Very responsible of you.
So when he was done doing that, John Smith came to...
Very easy to remember name.
Yeah, John Smith.
Love that guy.
And John Smith came to his village in 1614 and visited and kind of got to know the tribe. And then also when John Smith was there, he was like, oh, I like the name Patuxent, but I think we should call it Plymouth. Anyway, I'm off. And John Smith went off to another place and left behind one of his guys and said, you know, just keep talking to these people and keep an eye on them. And his subordinate said, yes, absolutely. But then kidnapped like two dozen natives, including Tisquantum, who also, as far as his name goes in the historical record, we know that's what he told the British his name was, but in their language it translates to Wrath of God. So he might have just made up a cool persona for him. So
that's your act break right there. What's your name, son? Wrath of God.
Right, exactly.
Fade to black. That's awesome.
So under his awesome Wrath of God name, he spent the next 5 years in hell, just having a terrible time. The unscrupulous British guy who kidnapped him, took him away and immediately brought him to Spain to be sold into slavery. He managed to talk his way out of slavery in presumably a language he just learned, so good job, and then worked his way to England, where he was a servant, but also basically a house pet for a very rich British man who just wanted to be like, oh, Native American, look at that, in his house. And then he talked his way out of that, presumably in a new language, and got a ride on a boat to Newfoundland. Then he talked to a guy there, said, hey, I'd really like to go back to Massachusetts. And the guy was like, yeah, sure, let's just go back and forth again across the Atlantic again. So he was on four horrible cross-Atlantic voyages, and then 5 years later gets back to his old hometown of Patuxent, and everyone is dead. Everyone, 90% of the population of Massachusetts died of some kind of viral hepatitis. And so what used to be his village of Patuxent was now the English colony of Plymouth that they built on top of it. And everyone he's known in his life is gone. And then also the region is a mix of a couple different Native American groups and the British, all like vying for power and trying to deal with each other. And none of the natives trust Tisquantum because he's been too close to the Europeans, you know, because they kidnapped him and stuff. And none of the Europeans trust Tisquantum because he's a Native American. And so what he does is play everyone against everyone for the rest of his life. He can work as a translator for people. And so he tries to convince the Native Americans that their leader's ineffective and that the leader that his tribe's ineffective and that they can't trust the British and so on. At one point, people are so mad at him that the leader of his tribe mails a knife to the British and says, please send me back to Tisquantum's head and hands, if you could.
And hands. That was a twist.
Yeah, yeah. He needs both. And then he just continues to basically survive all of the time in this horrible environment with all kinds of alliances that's also completely new, because in his lifetime, he went from living in a village to everyone he knows dying because of alien ships. And it's a typical way to be. And he eventually dies of just disease. He managed to just keep one step ahead of everybody and stay alive as long as he could. But he's not famous for any of that. He's famous for helping people grow corn by burying fish with it. And in 1491, which is an amazing book about kinds of things, but they say that the burying fish with corn is probably not even a Native American trick. It's probably, it's something that they had been doing in Europe for a long time, and he probably picked it up when he was a slave and a kidnappee and a servant in Europe. And so when he told the colonists in Massachusetts, like, hey, you could do that, he wasn't like imparting some kind of magic. He was just like, you don't know the basics of farming. You should do that.
It was just a WikiHow entry.
Yeah.
It was just, yeah, step one, the dead fish. So your entry is viral hepatitis? Is that what I'm gathering?
Yeah, I think that's who won.
No, that's end. That's incredible. Yeah, it sounds like a Yojimbo meets the end of Fallout 2, I feel like, where they won't let you back into the vault because you're tainted.
I feel like it's I Am Legend if he just like immediately realized he was the monster when he was like living in abandoned Manhattan and was just like, all right, I got to start playing these fucking Nazis, or not Nazis, but that'll come into play later. These vampires against each other.
Yeah.
Yeah, built on top of is an exaggeration. When he returned, they were living in the houses of the people who had died, like just like using their bowls. They were like, hey, man. And so like that's an underrated thing, I think, with him is that he didn't just kill everybody when he like got back because they were just like living in his home wearing his dead parents' like clothes and shit.
Yeah, I think he really, and I mentioned Game of Thrones because he really had, one of the things I love about that show is you'll just constantly see characters like, well, I'm in a new continent and everything's bad. And it just happens to him all the time where he's like, I guess I need to learn a whole nother language and convince people I'm the greatest again. And he just kept surviving in a situation that no one else in his position did. Like, no one else became the translator for the Pilgrims and the Wampanoag and everyone else.
Yeah, and we've talked about a couple times on the podcast in the past how it's really a glossed over period of history that when they first visited America, right, the Native American settlements were like vast, sprawling cities with huge populations. And it's not like Europeans just came and with our powerful, superior technology took over. We were aided by the fact that 90% of the people were wiped out by like an apocalyptic plague. And I've always thought like that is an amazing post-apocalypse movie, like pre-post-apocalypse movie.
Yeah,
and now we have the perfect protagonist. Like the life of Squanto is like the Revenant, except if he got there and everyone's dead and he doesn't know what happened. That's awesome, yeah.
Not awesome. I mean, kind of sucks
well,
for
see,
him, but
I was actually in a play once where I played Lord Wrotsley, this third Earl of Southampton, who is the evil British guy that kidnapped Squanto. So I have an agenda. I think this is all great that this happened.
All right, shall we confer? Does Alex beat nobody?
Yeah, I think he can stay out here for now.
All right, Alex, we're going to let you stay.
He zips up, and he's good.
Put it away, Alex.
Thank you, Alex.
Thank you.
Although it's a lectern, not a podium, so we'll be docking you points for that, I'm afraid.
Our next presenter goes by many names. The Sarge Party Weasel is a new one.
We're really hoping that sticks.
Yeah.
Use that. Hashtag Party Weasel.
He's a hilarious writer, performer, and cracked columnist. Joshua F. Sargent.
Oh.
Look at those elbow patches.
Entering through the door with elbow patches on. I think Alex has already been bested.
I was talking about this earlier. I don't remember when, as a kid, I saw someone wearing elbow patches, and I just said, that's what adulthood and success looks like. I'm going to aspire to that. I found out you can buy these for like $10 at Goodwill, which is where this came from. But
God damn.
Still feels like it.
Yeah, no, you look like $1 million bucks, man.
Thank you.
Sorry,
thank
Alex.
You know who else does?
So much nicer
you know who
him.
Else does this audience? That's right. Remember that when you're voting for me.
Pandering points right up top. Good job. Well done.
So, my guy, Akira, or Akira, is still around because history happens every day and is still alive, which is important to remember. He was born, he doesn't actually know when. It was in the early 70s in Cambodia. And the reason he doesn't know when is because the Khmer Rouge, before he was old enough to have memories, killed his family and made him a slave planting landmines because little tiny baby hands are the best hands for planting landmines, which is a horribly depressing thing that you now know because of Pol Pot. He did that for about 10 years. And then the Khmer Rouge was in a battle with the Vietnamese army that freed Akira and immediately had him plant landmines for them, which I imagine was disappointing. In 1989, the Vietnamese army left Cambodia, which I'm sure you already knew, and the Cambodian government came in and said, look...
Sorry, one person in the audience is like, what? They're out of there! I gotta go!
Cambodian army came up and said, you know, you've been really good at planting landmines. How about you keep doing that? And he's like, we're not at war, but okay. And he kept doing that until 1992, when finally the UN came in and asked him to help them remove landmines. Which he said, fine, that sounds great. He did that for 2 years. The UN said, all right, job's done. They went home to party in their Justice League or whatever. And the Justice League building was how that joke was supposed to go. But you know, you got it. You know, they left, job done. He said, well, we still have more landmines in Cambodia than people. There are 6 million unexploded landmines in Cambodia, 5.1 million people. So what he did is he spent that point in 1994 until now digging up landmines. And what's impressive about this is that, for context, when the UN shifts landmines, is what you call it, they have a team of 1,000 people, and in a month, they can remove 3,000 landmines using state-of-the-art equipment and training and state-of-the-art. Those two
little
things.
Baby
just
hands.
Those two things.
You told us. Yeah. Tiny little,
little
hands.
UN. Robot baby hands. Aki Ra, between 1994 and 2005, using a pocket knife and occasionally a wrench and no other equipment, literally a t-shirt and pants, removed 50,000 landmines. So
that seems like a lot. That is bad at math.
With okay, going
that's
back,
more than the UN one, right? The, yeah, yeah.
A UN 1,000 UND miners, 3,000 landmines a month. That's like three landmines a month for each yeah. D miner.
Okay,
36 landmines a year. That's a lot of landmines. I'm not shitting on the UN D miners. They're removing more landmines every month than I'm having sit down meals. But Aki Ra has, his record is 35 landmines in an hour. Again, with a knife.
In the time it took you to watch Hurt Locker.
Right, yeah.
He demined 120 landmines. I would love to watch that movie with that guy, and he's like, I don't just pick up the mine. I don't understand what the problem is.
Screaming at Jeremy mine. Renner.
How's he going to use the tiny knife with the suit and the helmet and the...
There are videos of him literally like he has his Leatherman and he's just like poking at the landmine, and then someone's filming it, and then someone nearby is like, everybody run! And they go and turn, like the camera's shaking and everybody's running, and then the camera comes back and he's just like picking at the landmine still, like, no, we're fine. Now, today, he is still doing that. Right now, probably. He has, I don't know the time zone differences, but if it's daytime in Cambodia, yes. He has a landmine museum that he runs that is full of landmines that he has...
You gotta put them somewhere.
Yeah, he's
turning them up.
Turn them into non-bombs to show tourists and people to pay for his continued efforts. And he also it serves as a home for children who've been injured by landmines. Because, again, the entire country is just fucking landmines in villages and farms, which you might notice is where people live and grow food. And mines are not only very bad for soil aeration and crops, but explode.
But what a landmine lobby they must have. Those guys are nailing it. I mean, when you get to the point where you're like, okay, everyone in America owns two toothbrushes, and you're like, crank up production. I need 18 billion more toothbrushes. That's confidence.
Is that it? Yes, that's all.
That's all he's done.
That's all that guy's done.
That's very impressive, and I believe I heard some audible gasps from the crowd.
I also just got a Google News alert. He has blown up, so I think it would be nice of us to give it to him.
All right, let's do a... Should we do the round of applause test?
I thought we just got to judge based on our whim.
That's the only way I got
this is
you.
Democracy okay. Swain. Yeah.
I was right. Promised let's obscene get, let's, amounts of power.
Let's stick with Aki Ra. Aki Ra replaces Squanto, who sucks, clearly.
Fuck you, Alex!
I don't know, but like he plants mines and then he takes apart mines. That's like one skill.
It's a zero-sum game. And it's a zero-sum game, right? It kind of just cancels out.
Yeah.
When you're around, I guess at the end of the day, he has like mathematically accomplished nothing. But yeah,
it does seem like he has a superpower though, which is cool. And he also has the name of somebody with, or like a Mortal Kombat character.
I think he's a giant baby who eats Japan. Does anyone know what the fuck happens in that movie?
All right.
Tetsuo!
Thank you very much, Alex.
Yeah.
and Squanto for giving us America.
Oh, wait, did we decide he won?
Yeah.
Alex's reign ended so quickly. Get out of here, Alex. You're done. You're done in this town. And Alex always exits caught last. Oh, it was too late with the bit. He didn't do it.
All right.
Who are we bringing out?
We're bringing out Blake Wexler, a hilarious stand-up who has worked on many of my favorite shows like Key and Peele and Review. He's a regular on the Todd Glass Show, the Nerds podcast. Please give it up for Blake Wexler.
Blake Wexler!
Blake Wexler!
Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
Hey, Blake.
Thank you for having me. This is not about me. I'm the badass. I have egomania. So in 1777, George Washington's army was camped out in Valley Forge, which is in suburban Philadelphia. And there was probably 12,000 troops that he had under his command. 2,000 that year died, that winter from hypothermia, disease, non-battle-related illnesses. So shit was looking real bad. And they hadn't won a single battle yet against the British. Meanwhile, in Prussia, Frederick the Great had released a man named Baron von Steuben from his army, and that's the guy, that's my badass, Baron von Steuben, and he was released for being gay, and that's why he was released, which, by the way, is what I want on my tombstone, is that here lies Blake Wexler. He was fired from the Prussian army for being gay. It's the most baller thing I've ever heard in my entire life. It's awesome. So he gets kicked out, and Benjamin Franklin, like, amidst having sex with numerous French whores, was like, oh, this guy is awesome. We need to get this guy. We totally need to get this guy. So Baron von Steuben gets not flown over. he hopped on the back of an eagle, and that's why it's so cool. Yeah, a gorgeous, beautiful plumaged eagle. I would imagine it was a boat that he got on. So meanwhile, Valley Forge, the Continental Army is camped out. Morale is horribly low. No one even has shoes. You know, people are losing limbs to frostbite, like, by the hour. And then all of a sudden, there's a noise in the distance. And it's like, it sounds like bottles clinking together. And then over a hill, Baron von Steuben arriving at this ragtag army. The noise, it was a bunch of jingle bells that he had affixed to a gorgeous, immaculately constructed sleigh. My man pulled up in a goddamn sleigh. A sleigh. And he was wearing a huge fur coat. These people don't even have shirts. He shows up in a fur coat while petting a miniature greyhound. Which, like, he invented the dog accessory, which is pretty cool. And on his sleigh, he has his chief of staff, not that odd, and then four of his young gay boyfriends. And it's just like, that's a fucking entrance. That's a hell of a fucking entrance. So he rolls up, doesn't speak a word of goddamn English. And it's just like, and just like trains the shit out of the army. These people didn't even know how to fix bayonets to a fucking musket, which I would imagine, rope, I don't know. But they didn't even know how to do it. And he teaches that. He teaches battle formations. He teaches how to a new efficient way of loading and reloading. And the first battle after the encampment at Valley Forge had ended, it was the first battle in the, throughout the war that the Americans actually held the battleground. So it turned the entire tide of the world, the war. He turned the tide. He turned farmers, literally farmers and lawyers, into professional killers, all the while wearing a fur coat and parading around with his little gay horse. Like, he was the shit. If that's not the most baller fucking badass, I don't know what the fuck's wrong with you. He was amazing. Give it up for Baron von motherfucking Steuben, everybody. Please, that's all I have.
Good hype, man.
Pretty good.
Yeah.
Did the
I'm ready for von Steuben to come out and start laying down tracks.
His dead body just drops from the ceiling and it's just like,
it sounds like he also invented Santa Claus. Like, it really, didn't it feel like he was leaning towards, and Coca-Cola was there and they were like, that guy will sell Coke. Get some polar bears.
But they made adult toys instead of regular toys.
I'm just impressed he stopped the soldiers from immediately eating his greyhound because
I know of all the food. Yeah,
I have a superb.
But they are very lean. It's a lean meat, and you would want something more fattening.
grim, but I'm curious, if they were losing a lot of limbs, you'd think they'd have a surplus of shoes, if anything?
Oh, that's funny. Yeah, but what if it was all, like, left shoes? Like, everyone just lost their left foot and it's like, oh, damn it.
I think there's, like, a bunch of stories from that time where they ate their shoes because it was, like, leather. They would just, like, soak it in water and then eat it because
it's basically a burger.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's right.
It's still,
we'll give that a shot later on.
Truly a badass. Also, I think for the added layer of getting it to come down in history, his true sexual orientation, you know what I mean? Because there are many historical figures who may well have been gay, but it's such a triumph to have history allow that to be remembered about you.
Yeah, and he was so, like, shamelessly himself, you know, like...
That they couldn't,
In terms of, like, the most homophobic arenas of the world, it's, like, the Army and then suburban Philadelphia. Like, those are one and two. And he served openly and proudly. Yeah, he was awesome.
And he did, like, change the tide of the war, right? Like,
we were
getting our ass kicked in the Revolutionary War, and he kind of came in and...
Yeah, and it was strategy. Like, obviously, you know, the British, like, were, you know, like, they're, like, formation lines and, like, they were hopping out of the woods, which, like, did work, but also, like, there needs to be some skill and some technique there, and he gave that to them.
Right. Sybil Ledington loosened the jar lid, you know?
Right. Was,
took the final step.
I was totally pronouncing that von Steuben.
I said Steuben.
That might be right, actually.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
This is a history lecture, not an English lecture. We'll do that next month.
Okay, cool.
All right, you want to keep moving people through?
Well, are we doing the applause-o-meter? What did we decide about? It disturbs me that we're this deep into the competition, and I don't know what we're doing.
How we're graded people. Yeah.
I think we should do applause-o-meter.
Applause-o-meter. All right, let's go von Steuben.
Or Steuben or Steuben.
Or Steuben.
Okay.
Aki Ra.
All right.
Run, Blake!
Well,
that was an amazing disappearance.
Blake is great at reading a crowd, isn't he? Can really read a room. He took off. I think we also at one point had vaguely talked about having the defending champions, like, poke holes.
Right.
We haven't done that yet, but whatever.
I don't know enough about Steuben, but I have another fact about Aki Ra that I remembered.
Please, what'd you save in the chamber?
It's very depressing. Of the baby mind planters that we already talked about, they tend to last about 6 months to a year after they start doing the job, but Aki Ra kept going. Yet another thing.
I'm sad now.
I really am. Our next presenter is a regular contributor to The Onion, and he's a stand-up known for producing a conceptual comedy show, one called 7 Minutes in Purgatory, which I watched on YouTube, which is definitely worth your time, where comedians perform in one room for a camera with noise-canceling headphones while the audience watches in another, so the comedian has no idea how they're doing and just, like, dies a slow death. It's really brilliant. With that in mind, please make very little noise to avoid startling Mr. Ian Abramson.
Yeah, the door sticks.
I'd hate it if you guys made a lot of noise. Wow, okay. How we doing?
They're terrible at following directions, we've established. So.
They sound pretty good at it, apparently. Would you guys agree? Go ahead and say yes. Listen, I don't know, man. They seem like they're on my side. Listen, shots fired. Do I just get going, or do you kind of leave me in? How does this work? I don't really know.
No, you go.
I go?
You go.
It's book report time, man.
Go. Oh, great.
Go for it.
You say shots fired, and then you get nervous. So, I don't know if you guys have heard of P.T. Barnum. I assume that on some level you have. You think circus guy. You might think liar, cheat. I think red-blooded American. You know what I mean? We stole this country is what I'm saying, and what better example than a man that built his career on lying and cheating. That said, he did it in a very honest way. As a child, P.T. Barnum was completely tricked, and this kind of set the tone of his entire life. He was told, as like an infant, to the time that he was about 12 years old, that he had inherited land from his uncle. And not realizing that this was kind of some kind of an in-joke with his family, people would just kind of be like, don't worry, when you come of age, you'll be inheriting Ivy Island. And in his mind, he doesn't realize all these adults are being sarcastic, so he kind of starts to get cocky about it. He starts to brag about it to his friends. His friends then go home, and their parents explain his family is basically making fun of him, and then he looks like a bigger idiot to his friends. So He comes of age, and somebody says, okay, we're finally going to take you to Ivy Island. And Ivy Island is basically just a completely useless swamp. And at first, he's completely heartbroken. He's downtrodden. He can't take it. But then he kind of thinks, like, this was a funny joke. This lasted years, and I am a stupid kid. So he kind of continues his life. He ends up becoming a shop owner. He's always had a kind of a penchant for excitement and kind of heightening the stakes, so he starts a lottery. And this did not exist in America before that, so he kind of had a part in starting the first lottery at his shop. And because that was controversial, he got some bad reviews, so then he started his own newspaper, which also allowed him to legitimately call out other frauds in newsprint, which got him arrested 3 different times. During the course of all of this, he's on the verge of bankruptcy and eventually hits rock bottom. He moves to New York and he says, I need to find the next big thing. What am I going to do? And he hears about in Washington, D.C., someone claims to have George Washington's nurse, the woman that says, she says that she changed George Washington's diaper. This is around the time of Abraham Lincoln, so it's about 420 years after George Washington became president for the first time. So he has no money, and he has to figure out, even if I sell everything I have, how am I going to do this? How am I going to get the money to buy this woman? Because slavery still exists at this point. Again, time of Abraham Lincoln. And he says, you know what? I have one thing I can put down as collateral. It's a family heirloom, Ivy Island. So the one thing that then tricked him for years became the thing that allowed him to really get started. And this woman would have been, I think, over 200 years old. Well over 200 years old. And so there's no way that that was true. And he must have known that. But to his dying day, he claims to have been fooled by it himself. That's the thing with PT. Good old PT. PTSD, you know what I mean? All right, guys. He was touring with George Washington's wet nurse, and what she would do is you would come in to like a big kind of conference hall, not a theater, because theaters were sinful. Theaters were like, it'd be like going to a strip club, you know what I mean? You're not going to take your family out to a strip club.
I have been severely disappointed by the lack of ones being thrown onto the stage, if I can just point that out.
There's going to be a collection tin later. That's
what
it is.
Pass a plate around, yeah.
Right. So you would come and she would just kind of sing songs that she claimed to have sung for Abraham Lincoln and...
Lincoln or Washington? See, your story's not even... That would have been my first clue.
I meant Nixon, all right?
That's so much better than her changing their diaper.
And I sang this to Elvis Presley 100 years from now.
So he toured with her. He ended up making a large amount of money off of a little person known as Tom Thumb, which became an international sensation. All the kings and queens of the world wanted to see him. He, in fact, did an impersonation of Napoleon to Napoleon, and even when they showed up that day, they weren't sure if they would be killed for doing it. So, you know, he's just a little boy who's even littler than a normal person, and he took that risk for both of them.
Like Webster little boy? Or like, did he appear to be a little boy or he was like a very small human being?
He grew up to be a little person, which was a strange sentence,
like,
I guess.
Really new on this.
Barnum started working with him when he was around 11, but he claimed that he was 9, but he said he was 11. That way he would look like he was older, and then the small size of him was that much more impressive to people that would pay.
I love someone who's like, that's the line. They're like, I mean, he's small for a 9-year-old. You show me an 11-year-old this size, and I'll flip my shit.
Right.
Like, what would they do at these shows? He'd just stand there and be little?
So that wouldn't be enough. You have a 9-year-old who would do impressions of big figures. So he would dress up as a Cupid. So just like a little boy, even littler, shooting arrows. Yeah.
Real bow and arrows got the audience, I imagine, at this time in history. Yeah.
Right.
The two he struck had to get married at the end of the show.
Absolutely.
Heard all about this. So your pick is a guy who got his start stealing a slave? Is that... Just to boil it down.
By the time he was done with her, she was freed. So you tell me what happened.
All right, okay. Fair enough.
And also, yeah, to his credit, when they were done, he went out of his way to give her a great life, mm-hmm. Because she was incredibly old, even though she wasn't 300, she was around 80. She looked so bizarre, just jumping back to her real quick. People weren't sure that she was real and started to believe that she was like animatronic, which was a different thing that would tour. There was a robot that would play chess, just like a clockwork robot that actually had a person inside. These are tangents upon tangents. The point is that this was in people's minds that maybe that's what she was. And so P.T. Barnum said, "You're right, it's not a human. Come and see her again. Pay me again, and let's go ahead. See this robotic woman."
What a weird accusation. I bet you're not a person. I bet you're a robot pretending to be a person that's really a person.
Right, right.
I would work on me, though. Like, if Guns N' Roses did a reunion tour, but promised this time they're all robots, like, they're all androids, I'd be like, all right, I'll see him again. Maybe one of their faces will fall off and you'll see circuitry, you know? But that's, yeah, I love you also brought up the chess-playing robot that was just a lie.
Yeah.
Just a guy looking at what they were doing and controlling a thing. So
it was a guy inside.
You love liars. You love fraud.
And so does America. USA! USA! Right? All right.
I think Barnum may be one of the most American. He could be America's spirit animal for sure.
I would definitely say that.
Like, whatever turn my life takes, I will make money through trickery using this new skill, whatever it is. Ballsy man.
He wasn't afraid to go to trickery, but really it was just about a big explosive show.
Yeah.
At one point, he decided, you know what? What I can get people to pay me to do is visit an iceberg. All I have to do is move an iceberg off the coast of New York. And the only reason he didn't go through with it is because it wouldn't be profitable enough.
So they crunched numbers and they were making like 3% net, but he wanted 5 to 8. It just wasn't. Like, does that imply it was somewhat profitable?
He would have been able to make a profit, but it would have melted before the time he would have been as rich as he wanted
right,
to be.
Exactly.
Is there any chance he was just a stupid person?
Yeah. Because I'm glad you just implied that he was aware it would melt. At first I thought he was just like, let's take that and move it here. Yeah, it really sounds like just what an 8-year-old thinks would make money. Like, let's just give everyone cookies.
Right.
Why has no one thought of this? In the mail, fresh hot cookies.
Moving on to kind of after he went from touring, he wanted to kind of stay put more often, and he opened a museum, which is another one of his major things. The American Museum it was kind of like the Disneyland of its day. Over 15,000 people would visit a day, which is, that's an incredible
more
amount.
Impressive.
And yes, right. Totaling 38 million in total paying customers, which was more than the population of America. That's
wow.
Insane.
That was genuine. I just sound like an asshole.
Wow. Yeah.
Also, all these numbers are pulled from Barnum posters, so I don't know how reliable. It's like, 80 billion people have come.
That is my favorite part about trying to research Barnum, is that he published 3 different versions of biographies over his lifetime, and all of them are completely contradictory. So, in some, he's like, I absolutely always knew that she was older, and some of them are like, I had no idea. I'm so sorry. Oh, boy.
My favorite thing I know about the American Museum, are you going to tell the egress story?
Please, go for it.
All right. Was that there was an exhibit called the egress, which I think you're supposed to assume is some kind of exotic animal, because they would also show, like, the mermaid, what's the name of that mermaid?
Little.
No. That's Ariel. Just like a monkey body sewn to a fish body.
Right.
The Fiji mermaid. Thank you very much, dark blob that I can't make out. But they also had an exhibit called the egress that if you were like, what's that? Let's check out the egress. Egress just means exit. And it would be an exit that locked when it closed, and you'd have to go around and pay again to get in. If you didn't know what the word egress meant. So.
And that's how he got those numbers up on his admission.
Count them twice.
Other things that were on the museum to kind of attract you, because he bought the museum. It already was a museum, and he was like, this place sucks. We can do better than just taxidermied animals. Let's put pictures of them on the outside, you know? So there were giant posters of these pictures, but there were also there was a lighthouse light on the roof surrounded by a garden that then you could look at the city, which now is just like your basic Silver Lake bar. But at the time, I mean, that was mind-blowing. This is also pre-airplane, and he had a hot air balloon that you could visit. So this would be like kind of your one chance to go into the air anywhere in the world. That's pretty insane for the like average paying person, you know, not someone that can afford their own hot air balloon.
Like we all can today.
Right. Yeah. I got here on a hot air balloon.
At one point, he would also have like these miniatures, because he would have to make sure that the museum felt like a museum. He couldn't have something that veered on the side of theme park, because if it felt too much fun, entertainment would be seen, and he would still get accused of like a sinful place. You know, he had to make it seem like you would come here to learn. And so he took out these huge ads and said, if you want to see a recreation of Niagara Falls, then come down, pay, and see this thing. And what it was just a model that was about this big. But he made the advertisement so convincing and worded them so carefully that the state of New York tried to shut down the museum for the water bill that he would have gotten.
For his tiny fountain.
Right, yes, exactly.
Yeah, for his desktop toy. Nice.
Any more stories?
Listen, I could go on forever.
Yeah,
right?
I feel like... You got all the
ones. If you have one more, which one would it be?
He worked with the first set of Siamese twins, and this is more about them than him, but I still love this story. They were already touring in other parts of the world, but they toured with him in America, and they hated him, and they hated each other. One was a total alcoholic, and the other one was totally sober, and so they did not get along at all. After like a year or two of touring with Barnum, though, they married an Irish set of twins on a farm, and they would stay half the week with one of them in one house and the other half of the week in another house, and they had 18 kids. Yeah. That I wish there was a little more research on. They wanted to get out of show business as quickly as possible because they were just kind of, they were literally bored.
They had 18
with their...
goddamn kids to take care of, man.
It's good for reason.
And so that's why they retired to this farm. But then they had to come out of retirement after slavery ended because they couldn't afford to keep up the farm when they no longer owned people. Yeah, so they had come from another country, but because they were rich, they were able to live in this weird space and then had to kind of go back to work with Barnum, retired again, and one day one of them passed out and the other one started freaking out and was like, what's going on? What's happening? And was screaming for help. Somebody went for help, and by the time they came back, he was dead. Hilarious, right? So...
Yeah, I see why you wanted to go out on this one. This is...
I mean, they did. So...
So the first one... So the first one had died, and the other one...
They were connected at the liver.
Realize. Ooh.
Yeah, and the alcoholic...
I was literally
going to
ask if they shared a liver, yeah.
Yeah, one's an alcoholic.
The alcoholic one's just like, fuck you, bro, sorry.
I see why they hated each other.
Yeah.
Yeah, so they had been to doctors and stuff in their lifetime to see if they could be separated, but no doctor could say with certainty whether or not they would be able to do it, and if they had tried, they wouldn't have survived. So, hey, USA.
Happy ending. Woo. Yeah, awesome. All right, let's go P.T. Barnum.
Someone literally made the, like, I'm ambivalent noise. It was fine.
Akira.
It's great to receive applause on behalf.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Thank you, Ian.
People are loving this.
It's great to receive.
Glorified guy at the beach picking up metal debris.
Yeah, yeah. It feels great.
I know, he already sucks in my mind. Just like, yeah.
For me,
bias.
It's great to receive applause on behalf of someone who has saved like an uncountable number of lives.
No, you earned it, man.
It's like, you're welcome.
Our next presenter is a hilarious writer, performer, and columnist for Cracked. Mr. Thomas Ryman!
Excellent sitcom name for entrance. You guys really dropped the ball, not all going, oh!
I'm going to talk about, I think, the first lady tonight, like this first woman that's been discussed.
Michelle Obama?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. No, it's her name's Rama Sukhana. Have you guys seen The Raid?
Yeah!
Woo! Raid Redemption.
Or,
excellent. Check it out.
Or its sequel, The Raid 2. Rama Sukhana was the lady who invented the fighting style that's used in those movies. It's called Penchak Silat.
You look at us like we could correct you if you said it wrong. Yeah.
Am I pronouncing it correctly, everyone? That's sounds about right.
Someone just leaps down, stabs you, and elbows you on the face.
If you haven't seen it, The Raid is about a bunch of Indonesian stuntmen beating each other to death in a series of hallways.
It is fantastic.
It's the best movie ever. It truly is. So a lady actually invented that fighting style, and she's kind of like a legendary character. There's not a whole lot of like real actual facts about her, except everyone agrees that it was this one lady. And the story goes that she's walking down to the river or whatever to do the laundry for the day, and you can tell how old it is because she's carrying her laundry on her head.
Tom's gesturing with a laundry basket on his head.
I have a whole bunch of props I just thought for like time. That whole outfit. So anyway, she's walking out to do the laundry in the river, like you do, and she sees the, according to different versions of the legend, I'm going to stick with this one first, she sees two monkeys fighting. One of them is attacking the other one with a stick.
Wise choice.
Yeah.
Sticking with that one.
He knew his limitations, so he was like, you know what, I better bring the stick.
The second monkey's like, what a great idea.
Yeah.
So you've never thought of this before.
A stick. No, 2001 hadn't come out yet. So she's watching as this monkey is trying to beat the hell out of this other monkey with a stick, and the stickless monkey is like doing this like dramatic series of getting the hell out of the way and like dazzling hand moves, like swatting it away and just really just avoiding every bit of assault that this stick monkey, we will call it, is unleashing. And she sits there, is just transfixed by this, as any one of us would be, right? If that was a YouTube video.
She just put that on TV.
Right.
That should have been The Raid.
Yeah. Just 90 minutes of monkeys beating each other to death.
The stick monkey, too.
Right. So she's so just really enraptured by these monkeys that she completely forgets what she went out to do, and it gets really late. She's like, oh crap, I better get back to my house. And she's, you know, nervously getting back to her house for reasons that will soon become clear. Her husband has been sitting at home this entire time wondering when the hell Rama is going to come back with his laundry and also with his dinner.
What a dick.
Right. Oh, it gets
fuck
better.
This guy.
Because he can't eat his dinner unless he's wearing a clean tunic, so both of those chores have to be done at the same time. So she gets back to his house, and he immediately sets into her with trying to beat the hell out of her for being late, because that's how they solve problems back then.
How's he roll stick-wise? Sans
no stick.
Stick.
He was stickless.
Great.
In actually every version of the legend.
Okay.
He is without stick.
It's the one thing they agree on.
No, he thought his hanger would be enough. So she sees him coming at her, which is with this, you know, in full where's my dinner bitch mode. And is trying to hit her, but she's like, oh no, I just watched these monkeys, so I know what to do. So she just lays into what the other monkey was doing to avoid the stick move, you know, like dazzling hand moves and deft head right. bobs and weaves, and he just cannot land a single blow. And this goes on until he gets tired. She's like, nope. Finally, it gets to the point where he's just like, okay, what are you doing?
What is this? What is this?
What is this that you... What sorcery have you brought into this house? And she tells him what it is, and then it becomes Penchak Silat.
Now, what do you mean she tells him what it is? Does it have a name that she...
Yeah, no,
or
she
does
shows,
he say...
She demonstrates it to him.
Okay.
Right. Hopefully breaking down the story. See, I saw these
but
two monkeys fighting.
The implication is like... Oh yeah, I went camping. I saw a bear take down an elk, so I took down an elk.
Yeah.
Like she's just like, I'll do everything that monkey did, of course.
This story was just so infuriating to everyone else to ever invent a martial art. They're like, oh, where did kung fu come from? Oh, centuries of studying. What about this one? I saw a monkey.
Just dip with the monkey.
Is anybody watching YouTube animal fight videos and being like,
it was a hardcore monkey.
So is it? It's, I mean, safe it's, to assume that she then began, like, honing it into a codified system of martial arts.
Yeah, she demonstrated what she had learned from this monkey. It's unclear where the monkey himself learned it. I assume he picked it up. He picked it up in prison, I'm guessing.
I feel like if you win, maybe the monkey should get the slot. It really originated the fighting style.
And it depends on the story. Sometimes it's a monkey and a tiger. Sometimes it's a crane and a tiger. Sometimes she's carrying the laundry basket and just fucking birds are coming at her laundry. So she just invents this style to ward off the birds and then still doesn't do the laundry because it always ends with the husband trying to hit her and she's like, no.
This has all the hallmarks of the true story.
Yeah. Well, Again, like I said, it's steeped in legend, but every version of it pretty much agrees that it's this one lady who came up with it, however she came up with it.
Right.
And, I mean, the main character in the raid is named Rama, which is, I mean, it's a common name, but still. There's some synergy there.
And the main move that I took away from that is stabbing a knife into someone's upper arm and then dragging it all the way down their arm. So it horrifies me to imagine that monkeys are out there doing that. I did not know.
Keep your head on a swivel, man.
Watch out, yeah.
Monkeys are running around with harpies. And
just breaking your spine across a balcony ledge.
Stepping on each other's
knees. God, it's a good movie. It's just...
It's really awesome.
Falls to the wall action, straight through. Let's watch it real quick.
Yeah, can we do that? We got a screen to come down. Yeah.
And so is she? She's alive?
No.
Okay,
this is olden days.
Centuries or decades later, at least they made the raid. Okay.
At least this was at least like 1972.
Gotcha. Yeah. Bruce Lee's still walked the earth.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Gotcha.
Love Boat was on the air.
Do we know if that actually works or does it just look awesome?
The person who made the film, Gareth Evans, I think is his name, he had originally gone there to do a documentary movie about the lead guys in the raid because they're these awesome champions of this style. And then he was like, well, I forget exactly how the story goes, but he winds up making the raid instead because I think because it was cheaper. Like, he just found the shittiest apartment building he could.
Yeah.
Like, it looks like the tenement from Candyman. And he's like, if I had a bunch of you guys run through this and just beat the shit out of each other.
Yeah, it's essentially plotless.
Yeah, it's the best movie ever.
It's great.
So, yeah, that's my pick.
Give us that name one more time again.
Rama Sukana.
My man Jack's going to have to say it right now.
You don't think I could remember? Rama Sukana.
There you go.
Are we bored of Aki Ra yet?
Aki Ra. Rama Sukana has it, I believe.
Was that a dethronement?
I think so.
Okay, we're calling it.
I think so.
We're going to call it? Okay, cool. Yeah.
Could you?
Well done.
Nicely done, sir. Up next is the newest full-time member of the Crack team, a hilarious writer, performer, and actress. She has a cat that pees magic crystals, is something we learned at the last live show, and many tattoos that are themselves cooler than me. Please give it up for Carmen Angelica. Yeah!
Let's talk about Ching Shi, the most successful pirate captain of all time. Woo! This is my opinion. And also, my opinion is fact. Born in 1785, became a prostitute to survive. Oh, by the way, she was a woman. Born in 1785, became a prostitute to survive, was born into poverty, married Captain Zhong Yi. I looked up how to pronounce that so I don't totally butcher everything. Leader of the Red Flag Fleet of pirates. Pretty scary at the time. Pretty scary
still
pirates.
Still scary, yeah.
Red Flag Fleet, yeah. I'm still scared of it. And then in 1807, Zhong Yi died in a tsunami, and she did not die in the tsunami.
Badass!
Because she's a badass.
They were both in the tsunami?
Huh?
They were both in the tsunami?
Yeah.
That is badass.
And she lived. She
cool,
lived.
Man.
He
she
died.
She surfed him Point Break style away from the tsunami.
Like,
surfed his body.
She stands up. She said, boy, that was some tsunami, huh?
And then she's like, oh. She's like, honey, did you feel that? Oh, no. Oh, all right. And then because he died, there were a ton of male pirates who were up for the throne. And she was like, no, 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 I'm in charge now. So she became in charge of the fleet, and it became one of the biggest pirate fleets ever, bigger than a lot of navies. She took over every single major pirate organization. She ended up with 1,800 ships and 80,000 pirates that she was in charge of. I know.
A murmur sweeps through the crowd.
I know.
80,000.
Get into it with me. This is great. Not only that, okay, but she organized an inland spy network. She had protection schemes. She was blackmailing people. She was the godfather. Before the godfather or any of the people that the godfather was based off of, she was the original.
Are we sure she didn't pay the tsunami?
No, I believe actually the tsunami paid her to have it ride it. You know?
That's hot. That's pretty hot.
Oh yeah. She was that badass. She also had a very strict moral code as a pirate. She would chop off the heads of anyone who broke the rules, and she would also chop off the ears of anybody who deserted. I don't know why that was a lesser offense.
Yeah. You're saying it's
so I thought you said deserved it.
She was like...
that's a pretty ambiguous moral code.
It's just open-ended.
Like, you're cool.
I think it was like, I think she was like, maybe they didn't hear me well enough when I said you can't leave, so next time I'm going to cut off your ears so that you just have a hole that my words go straight into. And she made sure that no women were mistreated. If they captured any women, they had to be released, unless the male pirate and the lady who was stolen was like, oh, I like you. Oh, I like you too. Let's get married. And then they both had to agree, and then they could get married, but if he cheated, she would kill him. So everybody was very faithful in her pirate troops. And then the Chinese government was like, oh, she's too good at this. Oh, she's stealing all our things. We can't do this alone.
Sick Chinese government.
And then they were like, they organized an imperial fleet, and they were like, hey, British, Dutch. And the British and Dutch were like, okay, we'll help you. And then they did, and then she met them head on. She didn't turn around. She didn't even like warp around them. Like, she met them head on and took 60 imperial ships with her. She took 60 of them. And then the Chinese admiral killed himself because he was like, I don't want her to capture me. So then the Chinese government was like, we don't know what to do, peace? And so they offered her a peace treaty, and she was like, only if every pirate was pardoned and allowed to retire unpunished, and they got to keep all the loot that they stole. And then she was like, my husband needs to be the new head of the Navy, because the guy before killed himself.
Was her husband a fellow pirate, or did she capture someone and then marry him?
No, she took a... I think when she became the head of the pirates, she was like, you're my husband.
You are my concubine.
And then he was like, okay.
Yeah, you don't want to know what she's going to chop off if you refuse that.
She's like, he gets to be the head of the Navy because I scared the head of the Navy so much he killed himself. And then she was like, but I'm done. And so she's like, but you can make me a noble lady. So she was like, she was considered the Lady of Imperial Decree. And she died in 1844 at the age of 69.
Well, now you just put me over the top. I'm sold now. Up to that point.
I just gotta say, I like pretty much researched her all day, and I was like, oh man, she's the coolest.
So many problems happened to all of us.
So she's a badass, and my new best friend if she was still alive.
Undeniably badass, although it is, we've done this topic once before, not live, but Unknown Badass is a history, and it is disturbing to me how often it equates to, they killed so many people, you guys. Yeah. Like, that does and stand out as repressive.
You said a badass, good ass.
No, totally, exactly.
She's right about that. We did say badass.
If you need a good ass, I'll read
No, next somebody. Month we're doing good asses. Overappreciated good asses of history.
I think there were probably even more killings that were hidden in there. I'm pretty sure she didn't take power by saying, no, I'm in power.
I think she was like, death, I'm in power.
Yeah. There you go. Cutting people's ears off so that the words can go directly into their head is not how hearing works.
It works for her, so I don't know.
But the fact that they were just like, I don't know, piracy's legal for you now in the world.
Although cutting heads off to prevent future crime, actually a very strong deterrent. People do not re-offend after, never mind. But it's really like if in the Wild West period, somehow the Jesse James gang had defeated the government. Like, that's what really strikes me about that one, is she pirated so hard that it seems like if she wanted, the pirates could have just become the government, but they chose to step down instead. That's terrifying, actually.
Yeah. I like that she retired to just, like, gamble. Like, she was just, like, just went to the slots. Was like, fuck it.
It was beautiful. It would be the coolest lady. I would be, like, sitting next to her with, like, as many quarters as I could get.
What if that's just what she wanted her whole life? It's like, well, this is how I know how to get it.
I think it was the only way she could become that gambling old lady.
It was, like, a 60-year plan that she had written out.
She was like, first I have to be born into destitution, and then I gotta become a pirate of all times, and then I can stop.
And that's what's great about piracy. There is so much room for advancement in piracy. Like, I was seriously doing cursory research on Qingxi because of this tonight, and stumbled upon another pirate, Said al-Hura, who became known as the Pirate Queen, and was also, like, born in destitute poverty, fled, took over a giant pirate flotilla, got pardoned, and married the King of Morocco, and, like, died old and happy.
Well, that's how I got this job. I was a pirate.
Yeah, exactly.
So, all right.
Women could be like murderous pirates a lot sooner than doctors or right. That's weird.
Yeah, society was like, all right, that's fine for you. All right, Qingxi.
Thank you,
I like your voice.
Whatever bullshit he talked about, I don't remember.
I think the honorable thing to do would be to kill yourself now,
I
think
her
is
too.
What we learned. All right, we have 20 minutes for you guys as badasses, if you guys want to start lining up.
Your prize,
hi Carmen.
Carmen, is you get to banter with the audience with us, so
yeah.
Welcome.
Yay.
Ooh.
I feel like we should have more to give her.
Do you want to talk about Zelda Fitzgerald?
No, never.
Okay.
No. I think we got a long line, and
right,
we should give these people a chance.
Like...
But yeah.
Okay. Hi.
So the one I was going to talk about was a man who actually died like 6 days ago at the age of 103. Joseph Medicine Crow, who was the last Plains Indian war chief. And he did that because there's four trials you have to do to become a war chief, which is you have to touch an enemy soldier without killing him. You have to take his weapon. You have to steal a horse. And you have to lead a war party. And so he joined the Navy in 1942, and then he eventually became a scout for the 103rd Infantry. And then while going around Germany at one point, he just ran into a German soldier, like literally turned a corner and just bumped into this guy, and he dropped his weapon. And so then Joe looked at him and went, no, dropped his own gun and then fist fought him. And then eventually started choking him to death, in which this German guy just yelled out the only English word he knew, which was mommy. And so then Joe went, no, you're not man enough for me to kill you, and then stopped and took him prisoner. And then later on, stole 55 horses from an SS battalion, and while he was doing it, riding away, just started singing a Crow tribal song, just like on the top of his lungs, and then eventually went home, became a historian for the Crow Nation, became the last Plains Indian war chief ever, and then lived to the age of 103.
Awesome. And well done. And you said, like, you don't have to strangle the person to qualify, right? You just have to touch him.
Yeah.
Like, he could have been like, tag, I'm a war chief, I gotta go.
Just like, boop him
on
the nose.
But he was like, no. Take off the gloves, take off the jacket. Awesome.
That's pretty cool. What's your name again?
Oh, I was Danny. Danny Kane.
Thank you, Danny.
Thank you, Danny.
Nice.
Awesome. Well done, sir.
Hello. My name's Sarah. Hi, Sarah. Another woman to submit.
Yes, woman.
Because, woo, you've probably heard her name. Her name was Hedy Lamarr. And she was a celebrity. She was a famous actress. And what a lot of people don't know is she was actually an inventor. She was an engineer in her spare time. And all the free time you have when you're a Hollywood actress.
Oh, my God.
She invented things like a more successful Kleenex box, a new kind of traffic signal. But the biggest thing she invented was with a man named George Antheil. And he was a Hollywood composer. And they had a conversation at a dinner party. And her thought was, if a piano can be synchronized to hop from a note to another, we could synchronize radio signals and remote control torpedoes for the war in Europe. And she did it. So the way that
women always turning everything into a weapon. Isn't that just the way?
That is the moral of this story, yes.
But careful, because you'll get killed next time you say that.
So the way it would work was she found a way to make the transmitter and the receiver jump simultaneously. So if you're trying to jam a radio signal, you'd be like, the signal's being jammed, boop, and you're fine. And it's just the guy who's trying to jam it cannot find the signal because both of them were moving together. So she took it to the Navy, she patented it, and she showed it to them, and their legitimate response was, go raise money by being pretty. For you have the boobs, and therefore, you can't also have a brain. This is before women were allowed to own them, and you can't do that. But
Sarah
she had
is
already...
reading from a transcript of the official statement. From
I
her.
Own it. It's on my iPhone. So
have we not the boobs?
If you prick me, do I not bleed? So... She sold it. She sold the patent to the Navy and moved on. And years later, after the war, they said, we have this patent called frequency hopping. A woman made it? Whatever. That same technology is now used for wireless phones, GPS, and military communication. She invented Wi-Fi and did not receive a cent for it, but we use it every day. And Hedy Lamarr was the person who came up
now.
With it. We're all stealing from her.
Thank you, Hedy Lamarr, for this signal we received.
Why is this not more... This is great. This is great that this is getting out, because why is this not more widely known?
More people need to know.
Also, we should expect more from our A-list actresses, I think. Why is Meryl Streep not busting out?
Yeah, she has the time, obviously.
All right.
Thank you, Sarah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Did they go back to a worse Kleenex box? I feel like Kleenex boxes are still a pain.
It's tough to imagine. Well, it used to be just like an old rusted metal thing with a jagged hole punched in it.
That you had to like reach into to get the... Sorry to shit on Hedy Lamarr after you leave. Yeah. Hi.
Hi, I'm Rocky. And my historical badass is a guy by the name of Samuel Johnson. And his number one achievement was the first comprehensive English dictionary, which is so thrilling sounding. But he was also the first man to annotate Shakespeare and wrote a series of different newspapers and magazines, all while suffering from PTSD, Tourette's, OCD, radical depression that at a point forced him to go to one of his friends, dropped off a pile of chains and said, hey, if I ever go mad, please chain me to the floor. And
in the meantime, I'll be writing down every word that exists. Just for the record, that part's sane. Don't worry about that. But if I act weird, chain me up. Okay.
So when he was commissioned to write the dictionary, he told the publishers, oh yeah, I can do it in 3 years. That didn't happen. His wife.
That takes time.
Yeah, it takes time. His wife, who was 20 years older than him, who he married, passed away while writing that. So
nice.
In the bouts of depression, he was very progressive for his time, was very against slavery, and his friends, who knew him very well, said, you know what would be a good gift to give him? Let's give him a slave, because that's smart.
Oh, no.
But he instead took this boy, his name was Francis Barber, under his wing and raised him to read and write and actually saw to it that this boy went to school, became a member of the British Navy, and when Sam passed away, he gave half of his estate to Francis Barber to help him move forward in the lovely years of the 1770s.
Hopefully he secured that sweet dictionary money. That's, I mean, that's like the happy birthday to you patent. That's got to be paying out still.
Yeah, do they get money for every dictionary?
The method that he used, well, his dictionary is no longer in use because now we have wonderful words like selfie and swag. The way that he wrote down words with the definition and the descriptions is the method that we still use today. Before then, the dictionary that came immediately before his had dog. The definition was a well-known animal, and that was it. That was it. That's all you
That's
got.
Awesome.
It's so, not wrong.
It's no, it's not wrong. It's not right. It's not fully right, but you're not wrong. So he fundamentally changed that.
You gotta love a dictionary that you open, and it's just like, you should know that one. Don't. School? What are you looking up school for? You know what it is.
The dictionary.
Get out of here. You
the
know.
Dictionary is just like insulting your intelligence the whole time. Like, you have to be checking me right now.
But like the definition for, I think it's like it's, or one of the really simple words has 84 different definitions in his dictionary, because fuck it, why not?
Yeah, it's one of those ideas that like seems simple and we take for granted, but you would have to be just completely batshit insane to like come up with in the first place.
And not only that, being able to do all that work while suffering from all those, he was also blind in one eye and just rude as
You're
hell.
Just making stuff up.
No, I'm not kidding. I'm not kidding. He was blind in one eye and he suffered from scrofula as a child, which left him horrible. Scrofula.
What is scrofula?
I don't know. It doesn't exist anymore.
A pirate lady cut his ears off. In the end, he was just a little snake body with a head, and he blinked out the dictionary. It was truly an inspiration.
He was very tall for his time. He's in an internet meme where it's like, oh, yeah, Shakespeare comes up with the word elbow. That's not a word. That other guy who's in that picture is Sam Johnson, and all of his portraits are way prettier than how he actually looked because he was large and hunched over. Like, imagine Igor, but a brick wall form of Igor.
I get that. If I had had the ability to have portraits instead of pictures, I would look great.
Right.
Oh, any art museum like the Heroic Era is only that. Like, it was a weird period in human history where all the rich people were like, photographs don't exist yet, but I can afford to pay you to paint me, make me look like a superhero. And that's why you have all these portraits like, Napoleon crossing the Alps on this beautiful horse rearing back. And if you see more historically accurate portraits, like, just no one from history looked anything like they look in paintings. Right. We didn't have Photoshop or airbrushing yet, so we just painted everyone. It was great.
Yeah, everybody had like horrible skin tags and stuff in history. Thank you. That
Thank
was
you.
Great.
Thank you.
Hi.
Hey.
Howdy.
I'm Graham. Nice to meet you.
Hey, Graham.
So my guy's name is Mad Jack Churchill. He's most famous for two quotes. He was a soldier who fought in World War II. First thing is, he's known for saying, any officer who goes into action without his sword is improperly armed. And he demonstrated this by going into battle with a longbow, his quiver of arrows, and a Scottish broadsword, and apparently bagpipes.
And this was World War II?
World War II. And I can only...
Yeah, I zoned out right at the top of your description. I was like, so what? Big deal. Everyone's out there with broadswords, right?
Yeah.
No, this is, yeah, Desert Storm.
I think the bagpipes are more impressive to me.
Yeah.
I can only assume that he's playing bagpipes while he's fighting enemy soldiers. But he led his commando unit of troops across Europe, like infiltrating towns and taking soldiers prisoner and doing the whole general badass soldier thing. But the second quote, when the war was over, he was apparently really down about it and was quoted saying, if it wasn't for those damn Yanks, we could have kept the war going another 10 years.
So just a bloodthirsty son of a bitch.
Yeah, just a complete maniac.
Great man. Awesome. I love it.
Thanks, Graham.
Thank you.
All right.
Great ones from the crowd.
I think that's all the time we have. Any closing words, Michael?
Zelda Fitzgerald was great. Look her up.
Yeah, check her out.
We'll probably do a part three of this, I think, someday, because
yeah, so.
There's so many people that don't get the credit they deserve.
Great. Thank you guys for coming out. Really,
thank you.
All right, that was our conversation. This is a live performance of While My Guitar Gently Weeps by Tom Petty, Steve Winwood, Jeff Lynne, and, of course, Prince at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction of George Harrison, I think. You might have seen it over the past few days. It's a pretty unremarkable performance for the first half. And then, you know, halfway through, to quote Jason Pargent on Twitter, Prince teleports onto the stage and everything changes. And the best part is, at the end of the solo, after he's just, like, shredded the stage for 2 minutes, he throws his guitar over his head, and it just never lands. It's an amazing thing to behold. Anyways, we'll ride out on his solo. On to footnotes. If you want to read more about any of the badasses mentioned during this week's show, we've got a list of links in the description of this episode on iTunes and on Cracked to short biographies and, you know, books about them, or you people know how Google works. Sybil, S-Y-B-I-L, Ludington, L-U-D-D-I-N-G-T-O-N. Tisquantum is T-I-S-Q-U-A-N-T-U-M. Akira is A-K-I-R-A-H. Baron von Steuben is B-A-R-O-N, von, V-O-N, and then S-T-E-U-B-E-N. P.T. Barnum, you probably know how to spell. Rama Sukana, R-A-M-A-S-U-K-A-N-A. And Ching Shi is Ching, C-H-I-N-G, Shi, S-H-I-H. And Fritz Duquesne, F-R-I-T-Z, D-U-Q-U-E-S-N-E. And also, if it sounded like it was fun to be in the audience for this today's episode, that's because it was. And you too can be a voice laughing in the background of a crack podcast if you come to one of our upcoming live shows. They're a blast. They almost always sell out. And here's some good news if you don't live in LA and want to plan a trip to see one of our shows. Starting in May and for the next 7 months, we'll be at the UCB Sunset Theater. the second Saturday of each month at 7 p.m. I'm not going to go through and list all the dates, but pull out a calendar. If it's the second Saturday of the month, we'll be there, May through November. May's show is just a few weeks away. It's on Saturday, May 14th at 7 p.m. right there at the UCB Sunset in Los Angeles. Soren will be hosting the show. He finally gets his wish to be a real boy and host a show. I might not be able to be there. If I am, I'll only be there as a guest. And we'll be talking about all the trivial things that people love to argue about. Like, for instance, toilet paper position, whether you stand or sit when using toilet paper, was a thing that came up in the forums as, like, somebody made reference to standing or sitting, and it launched this insane flame war, and we couldn't believe it. We had no idea that this was a thing, and somebody in the office was like, oh man, look at this flame war that's happening in the Cracked forums. And they were like, do you believe that some people sit? And they were like, yeah, I sit. And then a fist fight broke out and bottles were broken over people's heads. Anyways, we're going to identify a bunch of things like that that are secretly, you think everybody does them the same, but it turns out that's not the case. 50% of the population thinks the way that you do it is an act of war. Again, that's May 14th at 7 p.m. Tickets will go on sale Monday, the day this drops, and links will be up on the crack.com page where this podcast episode lives, and also on our SoundCloud page. And of course, you can always check sunset.ucbtheater.com. That's theater spelled the wrong way, the British way, T-H-E-A-T-R-E. That's it for this week's episode. Thanks to engineer Brett for editing this one together. You can follow him at Brett, R-A-D-E-R, on Twitter. You can follow me at Jack_O'Brien, O-B-R-I-E-N, and we'll be back next week with more podcasts. Talk to you guys then.
This has been an Earwolf production, executive produced by Scott Aukerman, Adam Sachs, and Chris Bannon. For more information and content, visit earwolf.com.